West London of several thousand Catholic schoolchildren who sang and cheered enthusiastically. Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.
The relief well that BP has been drilling in the Gulf of Mexico has intersected the blown-out well far below the ocean floor. We have details from NPR's Dan Charles.
BP started this relief well months ago. If all else failed, it was supposed to shut down the blowout. Now that the center pipe of the well is plugged with cement, though, the relief well has a more limited purpose. It will add an additional cement plug in the space around that central pipe. The job should be completed over the next 2 days. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Hurricane Carl is getting stronger and faster. The Category 3 storm has forced Mexican authorities to shut down oil facilities in the Gulf of Mexico. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Theo Bleckman talks about his love of show tunes and avant-garde music. He has a new CD. Join us.
Comes a rainstorm, put your rubbers on your feet. Comes a snowstorm, you can get a little heat. Comes light.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2444.
Welcome to Focus. Good morning. I'm Bill Hammack. Today I was to talk to Chris Goodall, author of 10 Technologies to Save the Planet, Energy Options for a Low-Carbon Future. It's a fascinating book that doesn't pretend the road ahead is easy, but instead lays out the complexity of alternate energy solutions. But alas, he was not available at the last minute, but the good news is we'll reschedule it for some time in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned for a program from the archives.
We like to believe that we can see what's in front of us, that our memories of the past are rock solid, and that we have a pretty clear understanding of how the world works. Our guest for this hour of Focus, psychologist Daniel Simons, says, in fact, these are distorted beliefs. They are not only wrong, they can be wrong in some very dangerous ways. In this hour of Focus, we'll talk about some of the research that he and other people have done in this field. And it is some of what you will find if you see his new book. The title is The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intuitions Deceive Us. The book is just recently out. It's published by Crown. It's very interesting reading. His co-author, by the way, on the book, I'd like to mention, is Christopher Chabry, who teaches at Union College. He's professor of psychology at Union College in New York. And Daniel Simons is professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois. And he's particularly interested in things like visual cognition, perception, attention, and memory. And right off the bat here, I'm sure we'll be talking about something that now he's become well known for, a kind of a little experiment demonstrating how sometimes we don't see what is in front of us. That does indeed involve a gorilla. More on that in a moment. Say, thanks very much for being here.
Happy to be here.
Can I get a definition here of visual cognition?
Sure. So visual cognition is a relatively new field. It's developed over the past maybe 30 years. And it combines work on visual perception and work on cognition, so combining how we see and how we think. It includes the study of behaviors like visual attention, distraction, reasoning, visual memory, a wide range of phenomena that you might think about in terms of thinking, but with an angle that's focused on vision.
Yeah. And the book looks at a number of areas, and I kind of hinted at them in the introduction, but it seems that the overall point is that while we like to think that when we're looking at the world, we see what is there, and that when we think about things that have happened to us in the past, that our memories are good and solid, and that we have a pretty good idea how things work, it seems that we are deceived in all of that.
That's right. So the focus on the book is a bit broader than visual cognition. It's on the nature of our intuitions about how the mind works in general. So we tend to think that we notice everything that's around us and that if something important happened, we'd spot it. We tend to think that when we recall a memory of some event that was really important to us and we remember it in vivid detail, that that vivid detail means that it's accurate, when often it's actually not. We tend to be too trusting in confidence, both in our own abilities and in the confidence of others. We tend to rely on confidence as an indicator of how good somebody is or how knowledgeable or how accurate, when in many cases it's just an indicator of personality.
Yeah. And these kinds of things really do have important implications, and as we go along, I'm sure that we can cite some examples, but that I suppose in short it is that based upon our perceptions and what it is we think about the world all through our daily life, we're making very important decisions about what we do or what we don't do, and whether that means you've been a witness to a crime or it just means you're driving down the street, or there can be all sorts of other ways in which your misperception can actually have pretty serious consequences.
That's right. So in the book, we discuss a number of different kinds of failures of perception, failures of memory, but those aren't so much the interesting phenomenon. I mean, they're interesting in their own right, but the really interesting thing is that we don't intuitively know that we do those things. So we don't intuitively realize that we don't notice things around us. We don't intuitively realize that our memories get distorted. And the result of that is that we tend to rely on our ability to notice unexpected things or our ability to remember the details of what we see around us pretty accurately, and we don't realize that they're being distorted.
And it seems that actually even if you try to prompt people, if you try to remind them of that fact so that there may be will be a little bit more vigilant or a little bit more careful in the way they're thinking, that it actually doesn't seem to help.
Well, I wouldn't say that it doesn't help. In fact, that's one of the goals of this book, of course, is to make people aware that your intuitions about how the mind works aren't always right. but you're right. There are some limits in how much it will help. It's not going to get rid of these limitations on how the mind works. So visual attention is limited. We can only take in a subset of what's out there in the visual world and become aware of only a limited amount of what's around us, even though we think we take in almost everything. We're not going to get rid of that limit. That's a structural limit, in the same way that you're not going to suddenly be able to see ultraviolet light. It's a cognitive limit. It's a limit on the mind, but you're not going to make it go away easily. And in fact, it's a side effect of something that's a very good aspect of how our mind works. Yeah. But making people aware of it, making people aware of these assumptions that we're making about how our minds work, that we can change because that's our thinking.
Well, I want to now have you talk about the gorilla. This is something for which you've become pretty well known. And the video of – there's a little video clip that you have used in this experiment that – If now, after having heard us, if people go look at the clip, they're not going to be able to really test themselves. But it's something that you've done, and it's been widespread, and a lot of people have looked at it, and indeed involves a gorilla. So tell the story.
Yeah, that's right. So that was actually the motivation for the book in the first place. Chris Chabris and I, many years ago, back when I was teaching at Harvard and he was a teaching assistant, we taught an undergraduate laboratory class. And one of the projects in the class was a group project. We had all the students in the class helping with this project. We filmed a video that was based on some earlier work, actually about 25 years earlier, by Ulrich Neisser, who's one of the founding figures in cognitive psychology. But he had done these studies in which people were asked to watch a simple game, people passing a basketball, and count how many times, say, the players wearing white shirts passed the ball. And they'd move around each other and fake passes and sometimes bounce the ball. And all you had to do was keep track of the total number of passes. He also had three players wearing black shirts passing basketballs, and you were supposed to ignore them. Now, in his videos, the players and the balls and everything else in the scene were kind of partially transparent and overlapping, and that was for theoretical reasons. He was trying to study something about the nature of attention and whether it focuses on areas or objects. But in the middle of this game, as people were doing this, he had a person carrying an open umbrella walk through the middle of the scene. And what he found was that a lot of people didn't notice it. But the videos were kind of weird looking. They were kind of ghostly. They were hard to see. And when people failed to notice it, they say, well, yeah, it was really hard to see. So what we wanted to do in our project was basically to replicate that original study, but to make it so vivid that if people missed it, they couldn't have any excuse for missing it. It would be clear that it had to do with the limit of how cognition works and how perception works. So we did exactly the same thing. We had three people wearing white shirts, three people wearing black shirts, passing basketballs among themselves, and people counted how many times the players wearing white, or in some cases the players wearing black, passed the ball. And in one of the variants of it, we had, after about 30 seconds, a person wearing a full-body gorilla suit walk onto the scene, stop in the middle of the scene, face the camera, thump its chest, walk off the other side a total of 9 seconds later. And when we ran this, we thought it had no chance of having any effect. We thought everybody would notice it. We kind of ran it on a lark just to see if it would work. And it turned out that half the people watching the video didn't notice this person in a gorilla suit. Uh-huh. And they were shocked when we showed it
to them.
Well,
you can, and if now, and again, there's a link to this on our website. So if people want to go and look at it, and I think that that's the reaction you'd have because you're, first of all, you know what's going to happen. So you're sitting there, and as you say, you're these people passing basketballs back and forth. And so if you're not really paying that much attention to that, then very clearly, here comes this person and just sort of strolling, just ambles in right in the middle, stops, looks at the camera, and then ambles out. And as you say, what happens is if you tell the people now, here's what we want you to pay attention to, that half mm-hmm. of the people will not see the person in the gorilla suit. And then afterwards, what you do is you say to them, now, did you notice anything, you know, unusual? And they say, no. And you say to them, and did you see the gorilla? And they, of course, they say, what gorilla? And that's and knowing, you know, what you're looking for, it's hard to believe. You'd say to yourself, now, wait a minute. How could anybody possibly not see the gorilla?
Yeah, it's startling. And my colleague Dan Levin and one of his students, Bonnie Angeloni, looked at doing exactly what you suggested. Now that we've told you about the gorilla, that effect's not going to work on you. But if we told people about the gorilla effect and didn't tell them that people missed it and asked them how likely do you think people would be to miss it, most people say, well, yeah, of course. 90% of people say, yeah, of course you'd notice that. And, mm-hmm. and they're confident that you would. That's the intuition that's really hard to counter. And in fact, it's so hard to counter that for years, whenever I would show this video to an audience giving a talk, I'd hold my breath because I was convinced that nobody in the room would notice it. Or no, everybody in the room would notice the gorilla, the effect wouldn't work, my talk would be a flop. And after a while, I had to learn to counter that and say, okay, I know everybody should notice this. It's right there in front of them, but somebody's going to miss it and they'll have the effect.
And so pretty much you've gone around and you've shown it over and over, and other people have shown it. You've shown it different places, and pretty much the result is pretty consistent that around half of the people who you, if you do it like as we described, about half of the people will not see the group.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, now I have to qualify it by saying half of the people who've never heard of it before.
Well, but, yes, once you've got the point, then it's not going to work.
That's
but
right.
But if you get someone who's completely unexposed to the idea and you can set it up right, about half.
That's right.
They won't see the
gorilla. It ranges. I mean, it depending on the setup you use, I've had some audiences where I can get up to 90% missing it and other audiences where I get maybe 20%. And it varies based on how well I set it up. If I really make it an intense task, so I set up a competition between, say, the men in the room and the women in the room and see who can count better, that often inspires mm-hmm. people to really focus on the counting task. And to the extent that you really focus on the counting task, you're more likely to miss the gorilla.
And this is an illustration of something called inattentional blindness.
Yeah, it's a kind of a clunky name for the phenomenon. The idea is that the reason you miss the gorilla is that your attention is focused on something else, in this case, counting passes. So you've got no attention. You're inattentive to the gorilla. So you're blind. You don't see it consciously because you're focused on focusing your attention on something else.
Yeah. And I suppose that what that also does is this makes this larger point that there is so much, as we're going around in the world, there is so much stimulus coming in. There's a lot of visual information, there's auditory information, there's all kinds of stuff. We're just bombarded by it, that there's no way that we can actually take all that in. So
yeah.
We have to narrow our focus.
And that's a good thing, right? So inattentional blindness is actually a side effect. It's kind of a consequence of how the mind works and the limits of the mind. But those limits are actually a good thing. If you think about it, being able to focus attention is one of the few things that allows us to get anything done. If you were constantly distracted by irrelevant things that were happening around you, you'd never be able to get what you wanted to do done. So by focusing attention, you're able to filter out a lot of the distraction. A consequence of that is you sometimes filter out things that you might want to see.
Yeah. And there, an easy example is if somebody is driving, this kind of problem here, if your attention is focused elsewhere or you're distracted, this can cause accidents.
That's true. And that's actually one of the things we focus on the most in the book is the issue of driving and distraction. So one secondary study that we did as part of the original experiment was to look at what happens if we make this counting task more difficult. Right. And in a sense, you can think of that as simulating trying to do two things at once. Mm-hmm. So what we had people do was keep two counts, one of passes that were thrown through the air and one that bounced. Right. So you have to keep two running totals simultaneously. Every time there's a bounce pass, you add one to the bounce pass total. Every time there's a pass in the air, you add one to the pass in the air total. And then you're asked to report those at the end. This is a lot more difficult. And what we find is that it decreases noticing quite a bit. The more you're having to focus on something else, the more focused you are, the less likely you are to notice things. We're not good at multitasking. And when you give people additional demands on their attention, given the limits on our attention, you're that much less likely to notice something unexpected.
Yeah. And people, I'm sure that people, at least some people, actually think they are good at multitasking and that this gets to be a problem where people are doing something like, oh, let us say, talking on the phone while they're driving or doing something else while they are driving. And now, of course, as we know, distracted driving is a real serious problem.
It is. And part of it is that our intuitions about what we can and can't do while we're driving are faulty. And the reason they're faulty is we rarely get feedback that we're doing anything wrong. Mm-hmm. So all of us have seen other drivers doing really dumb things while they're driving, on talking on a cell phone, running lights, weaving in and out of lanes. The problem is that as they're driving and they're distracted, they have no idea that they're doing those things. So as far as they're concerned, they're driving just fine. Ellen Goodman made a nice comment about this that I'm paraphrasing, but everybody else who's driving and talking on a cell phone is crazy, but I can do it just fine. Right? And that's exactly the problem, that we think that we can do it just fine because we rarely get the feedback that we're not doing that fine. And most of the time, we'll be fine. Right? So most of the time, you're not going to have an accident when you're talking on a cell phone. You might go your entire life without having an accident while talking on a cell phone. And the feedback you're getting is that you're doing it with no problems. Mm-hmm. The problem is that it's those rare unexpected events in driving that are the ones that are catastrophic. It's the kid unexpectedly stepping out in front of the street. It's the bicycle that you didn't see. And when you're distracted, you're slower to respond to unexpected things, and you're much more likely to miss them. There have been a number of studies looking at the effects of cell phones on driving performance, and the effect of holding a cell phone conversation is roughly comparable to the effect of driving under the influence of alcohol. And people don't realize that it has that powerful an effect. And the bigger element of this that people don't realize is that it has nothing to do with holding the phone. So if you look at all of the legislation that states have passed to ban cell phones while driving, it's all banning handheld phones. There's 7 states so far that have passed legislation. There are a number of others that have it in the works. And all of them are focused on banning things like texting while driving, which is horrific, horrifically distracting, but also banning handheld phone conversations. And the problem is it has nothing to do with your dexterity, your ability to hold a phone and drive. People with one hand, one arm can drive. People can drive a standard transmission, manual transmission, just fine. The problem is in your head. It's how demanding it is to hold that sort of a conversation.
And there's some other things obviously we want to talk about. I don't want to completely get us off on cell phones, but mm-hmm. Why does it seem to be the case though that it is not, I suppose it can be as distracting, but generally it's not as distracting to have a conversation with a person who is sitting next to you in the car?
It's a great question, and it's one that often comes up when talking about this sort of issue of driving distraction. And most of the evidence to date shows that it's not anywhere close to as distracting. In fact, there's some studies suggesting it's not distracting at all. My bet is just the measures aren't quite sensitive enough there. Lots of things are distracting. Having a child in the backseat screaming is distracting. Talking to a person in the car is not as distracting as talking to somebody on a phone. And there are at least 3 reasons, 2 of which are somewhat uninteresting and 1 of which I think is really interesting. So the most uninteresting one is just one of hearing. It's much easier to hear somebody sitting right next to you. They're clearer than it is hearing somebody over a cell phone. It just takes more effort to process the information. It's more, it's just not as clear an auditory signal. So the simplest explanation, and one of many, is that you can just hear the person better, so it doesn't take as much effort to listen to them. Mm-hmm. The second, which is, I think, a little bit more significant, is that a second person in the car is a second set of eyes, and they're going to be focusing on different things. They're not going to be as attentive to staying on the road, for example. What that means is if something unexpected happens, you just happen to have an extra chance of noticing it and having them tell you to watch out. So that can be a benefit as well, that can lead you to not having as much consequence of being distracted. But the third thing I think is the most interesting, which is that there's an interesting social demand whenever you're having a conversation. If you're talking to somebody in a car and you're having a conversation and you're driving and you suddenly stop talking, the first thing your passenger is going to do is to try and find an explanation for why you stopped talking. And what they're going to do is look out at the road and see, is there some traffic? Is there some difficult tactical driving maneuver you have to do? Are you passing somebody? Are you coming up to a stoplight? And if they see that there's an explanation for why you stopped talking, they'll stop talking and they won't expect you to keep talking. On the other hand, if you're talking to somebody on a cell phone who doesn't have that shared social context, they have no idea what you're doing, what the situation is on the road. So if you stop talking, they don't know whether your cell phone just cut out, whether their cell phone just cut out, whether there's some awkward pause for due to the meaning of the conversation, and they're going to put a strong social pressure on you to keep talking. So on a cell phone, there's much more of a demand to maintain the conversation in a way that there isn't when you're right there in person with somebody.
Yeah, very interesting. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Daniel Simons. He's professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois. He's interested in perception, attention, memory, has written about some of his work and some of the work that others have done in the book The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intuitions Deceive Us. It's published by Crown, just out recently. He's co-authored this with Christopher Chabry, who teaches at Union. He's a professor of psychology at Union College in New York. And we're talking about this subject and how it is that maybe we think we see the world very clearly, but psychologists and their research will tell us no, we don't. And for some interesting and maybe important reasons. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu.
I was just going to say one other thing. Now that we've talked about the gorilla video and made it so that you can't really experience that effect for yourself, if you search YouTube for the monkey business illusion, that's a new variant, that one you can try for yourself. So it's a similar task, but go ahead and try and experience it for yourself, and I won't spoil it for you.
Okay. I'm just going to have an email here from someone who said that they, in fact, had seen the video. He said, I saw that the video that you made used in a BBC British bicycle safety ad and said that it was being sent around on a cycle listserv that he's on. And in fact, he says, yes, he did not see the gorilla. He said, I was pretty shocked that I had that experience. And he said, in fact, he thought it was one of the most effective TV ads that he's ever seen.
Yeah, it was actually an interesting experience. That the ad was kind of a knockoff of my video. It wasn't actually my video. It was run for by Transportation for London, which is a government agency that deals with bicycle safety, among many other things. So it was run as a bicycle safety ad, but it was basically the same sort of thing I did, just enough to be within legal limits.
And copyright. I think it really, one of the things that this whole thing illustrates is that it seems that as we are going around through life, going around through the world, we're looking at things happen as they happen and the way things happen every day. And it seems that we're put together a sort of set of expectations on what will happen based on what has happened. So that we get settled into patterns of, and if day after day after day things kind of go the same, then you have a problem then where on the one day when something very unexpected happens, it doesn't fit in with this pattern that we've seen day after day after day, and it may indeed, well, it certainly will catch us by surprise, but it may also get us into trouble.
Yeah, people are fantastic pattern detectors. That's something that we do through all aspects of our lives, and we do it on a moment-to-moment basis and over long periods of time. So in the context of driving again, one of the interesting things that we find in driving research, this isn't my own research, but a lot of other people have looked at this, mm-hmm. is that what you see on a daily basis affects what you're likely to see, what's likely to happen. So if you look at rates of collisions between cars and pedestrians or bicyclists, There's actually data that you find more collisions in places that have fewer bicycles and people. The towns with fewer bicyclists and fewer pedestrians are more likely to have pedestrians and bicyclists hit by cars. Towns with lots of bicyclists and lots of pedestrians tend not to. And the reason has entirely to do with expectations.
Yeah.
If you know that tons of people are going to walk out in the street in front of you, you drive differently. You're looking for pedestrians. The same problem applies for motorcyclists. So if you have motorcyclists who are – if it's really common to have motorcycles in town, people are going to be looking for them. If it's unusual, people aren't. And we're very good at detecting that pattern. If you're not seeing motorcycles, you regularly don't see them. You don't expect them. And no matter how many watch for motorcyclist signs you put up, you're not going to change that basic pattern perception mechanism. So there are a lot of campaigns for watch for cyclists, watch for motorcyclists. And those likely have an effect for 20 seconds, a minute after you see it. But then you stop seeing motorcycles because there aren't that many of them. And the result is you go right back to detecting patterns. If think about it this way. If I were to tell you, hey, watch out for gorillas, and then 2 weeks later show you my gorilla video, you're not going to have any benefit from me telling you about it.
Yeah. We have a caller to talk with, someone who is listening in Indiana. So let's talk with them on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, we got you. Go ahead. Yeah.
It's Indiana?
Yes, go ahead. Yep.
Couple things. I didn't get it at the beginning, but a couple times you were talking about, I think if I remember correctly, situation. 50-50, which doesn't seem particularly important to me. What about the people that do these tasks that others fail to do? What are we saying about them? Who can sense do multitasking, quote-unquote, whatever situation you put them in? I'm sort of worried about the tightness of the experiment myself. It seems to be some quick philosophical jumps from one thing to another, and I just wondered a little bit more... Are you checking yourselves again with other participants and stuff like that? But I'm really interested in those people who are off. Because I've got a teenager in the family who thinks he can do about anything. And unfortunately, he can. Doesn't mean he's not going to kill somebody in his car, but he seems to do these things pretty well. I've watched him, questioned him, all that kind of stuff, trying to explain to him how dangerous it is. And he just looks at me like, you're just an old man, don't know anything. But what about those who are off in your experiments?
Okay. Well, and I think if I hear what the caller is asking, one of his questions was, in fact, one of the questions that I had was, well, for those people who do see the gorilla, what's the difference between them and the people who don't? And why is it that in fact some people do see it?
It's a fantastic question. So there were a couple of issues that, that the caller raised. One was, you know, how robust is this effect? Is this something that repeats? And yeah, this is an easy to replicate effect. It works on about 50% of the time, and we've run it everywhere from Harvard to large audiences of people who are largely uneducated. It doesn't seem to be tied to things like intelligence. The best predictor seems to be whether people try and do the task that we give them. If they don't try and do the task, if they don't bother counting passes, they tend to notice the gorilla. To the extent that they do the task, about 50% notice it. Now, there's a really interesting question there. What is it about the 50% who notice and the 50% who don't? And there could be a couple of possible factors here. One, and I think this actually is the most likely, is that it's just random. That on any given trial, any given attempt, about half the people will notice. If you didn't notice the first time, if we could do the study again, you'd be about 50% chance of noticing it the next time. The challenge of looking for individual differences in this sort of task is you can only do it once. Once I've shown you the video and asked you whether you noticed a gorilla, I can't show it to you again because you're now expecting gorillas. So it makes it very hard to do a study of reliability to see how likely it is that the same person is going to miss it over and over and over again, or whether that person would miss it 50% of the time. So that's the real question is there some stable individual difference here that predicts whether or not somebody's going to notice? We've looked at a number of factors that might contribute to this. So one factor that you might think would contribute is working memory ability. So how much information can you hold in mind while you're doing something else? And that predicts all sorts of basic measures of performance. It predicts how well you can do counting in these sorts of tasks. It doesn't seem to predict whether or not you notice unexpected things. Similarly, we looked at how well people can do the counting task in the first place. So are people who are better able to keep track of multiple moving objects more likely to notice the unexpected event? And it turns out, in a study that I did with one of my graduate students, Melinda Jensen, no. It doesn't seem to predict how likely you are to notice something unexpected. It predicts how well you'll do the tracking task, but not noticing of unexpected objects. There might be personality factors, and that's something we're looking at now, individual differences in personality that predict how hard you're going to try to do the counting task that might also then predict whether or not you notice. But there doesn't seem to be a difference in basic perception and attention abilities between people who do and people who don't notice. Now, there was an extra question in here about whether children, for example, or teenagers are better able to multitask and better able to do this sort of task well. And it's a really interesting question. Most of the evidence looking at multitasking is that nobody does it well, or very, very few people do it well. People may think they do, and they may think that they can do five things at once, but it turns out that if you look at their ability to do any of those five things, they're doing much worse than they would be if they were doing them one at a time. People are generally not built to multitask, even though we might think we are. That said, kids are sometimes better at some sorts of things. So younger people tend to have faster response times. They do react faster. They might not have the judgment to know when they need to react, but they tend to react faster than older people do. That might mean that they could track multiple moving objects faster, like counting the passes more efficiently. But that doesn't seem to predict whether they notice unexpected things.
Yeah. We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Our guest is Daniel Simons. He's professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. If you're interested in reading about these things that we've been talking about, you want to look for the book that he has co-authored. The title is The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intuitions Deceive Us, published by Crown. We got someone here who's calling from near Lovington on our line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I hate to interrupt you because it's so interesting, all the things you're saying, but I just wonder, where do you draw the line on what multitasking is? Like right now, I'm definitely multitasking. But, you know, when I'm sweeping the floor at home, I'm thinking about a couple different things there too, you know. We hardly ever do one task that, you know, the only thing that wouldn't be multitasking would be, I suppose, staring at a dot in some kind of meditation. And I just... You know, it seems like, you know, we got extreme with phones and driving and all that stuff, but, you know, we've always done it to some extent. I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
So that's a really interesting question. So what does it mean to multitask? And the way to think about multitasking is doing more than one thing that relies on the same kinds of processes, right? So talking on a cell phone and driving both actually tap into some of the same cognitive processes. Sweeping the floor and listening to music and might not tap into the same sorts of cognitive processes. And that's right. We do multitask all the time. The question is whether the multitasking that we're doing is whether the two tasks that we're trying to do or more tasks that we're trying to do interfere with each other. And they're going to interfere with each other to the extent that they use the same sorts of processes. If you think back to when you were learning to drive, I know we keep coming back to driving, but if you think back to when you were first learning to drive and when you were doing that, your hands would be white-knuckled on the steering wheel. You'd have to think about how hard you have to press the accelerator to get to the speed you want while you're watching the speedometer the whole time to figure out how fast you're actually going. When you were doing that, there's no chance you could actually hold a conversation with anybody. You probably couldn't even turn on the radio. But eventually, a lot of those sorts of physical aspects of driving become automatic. They become automated so that you no longer actually have to think about them. You no longer have to use cognition. And once you make those tasks automatic, you can do them without actually having much cost to other things that do rely on your cognition.
Yeah.
What's interesting about cell phones and driving is that you can't seem to automate those sorts of cognitive tasks that interfere with each other when you're doing those two things. So they continue to interfere with each other no matter how much you've talked to people on the phone and no matter how much you've driven.
I have another caller here. I have an email. For just a minute here, I'd like to have you talk about something that relates to what we've been talking about here, just again to kind of underscore the point. And we started out talking about this thing that in your business you call inattentional blindness, and the study about the gorilla illustrates the fact that if people are within their environment, if they're really concentrating on a particular thing, that then there could be other things going on that they're not going to see. And in fact, what I think it's interesting about the invisible gorilla study is that somebody did this study and they actually tracked people's eye movements, and they found out that in fact people actually did look at the gorilla. So obviously there's something going on in their brain that is getting screened, that information is somehow coming in, but it's getting screened out. So the thing that I'm interested in is something called change blindness, which again goes back to this idea that we have certain expectations about what's out there and how that kind of all fits together. That's no doubt, I'm sure, based on previous experience. And that means that sometimes small things can change and we just don't see it.
Sometimes big things can change. So the gorilla effect illustrates that looking isn't the same thing as seeing. So just because you direct your eyes at something doesn't guarantee that you're actually going to become aware of it. Change blindness is in some ways more of an illusion of memory. We think that we're going to keep track of details in our visual world, and we often don't. We don't actually store them in the way that we think we do. We think we have access to them, but we really don't. And one of the most obvious places this happens is in the movies. So you've probably all noticed an editing mistake in a movie where somebody's eating a Twinkie and then they're eating a pancake and then they're eating a Twinkie again, or their jacket's on their shoulders and then it's on the chair. Those sorts of errors in movies happen all the time. And I've had people come into the lab and tell me, oh, I always notice those errors in movies. And I can guarantee you that they don't, because we run them in a study where we made a movie with intentional mistakes and we find that they didn't notice any of them. Mm-hmm. Right? But why do they think they notice them? That's a really interesting question. That's where the illusion comes in. They think they notice these edits. They think they notice these mistakes, but they actually don't. And the illusion comes from just our experiences. When you're watching movies, if you notice a change, then you know you've noticed it. You're not aware of all the ones you didn't notice. Mm-hmm. So as far as you're concerned, you're always noticing errors in movies because you're aware of all the ones you noticed.
Yeah. So, and I presume that the reason that people don't notice it is that they're so absorbed in what's going on, they're absorbed in the action, maybe what the characters are saying, what's going on, that something like that can happen, and that's they just don't notice because they're really paying attention to something else that's going on.
That's actually not the reason for this effect. To do with how much information we actually take in. So if you think about the gorilla effect, you're not noticing this gorilla. Well, imagine you're just looking at a photograph or looking at a movie. Your attention is limited. You can only take in so much of that scene at once. You can't take it all in. So even if you're actually looking for changes, if you're trying to find changes, you often don't spot them. And we have this intuition that, of course, if I were looking for a change, I'd spot it. But here's one example of a study that we did that kind of illustrates how big this effect is, how much we can miss. This was a study I did with my colleague Dan Levin 16 years ago now. We were on a college campus, and we'd have a friend who would walk up to a pedestrian and ask them for directions. So pretty natural conversation. The person starts giving directions. And in the middle of their conversation, Dan Levin and I came by carrying a big wooden door and just rudely cut right between them. And while the door was blocking their view, we replaced the original person looking for directions with me. Right? So we switched the person they were talking to right in front of them in a matter of a second. And what we found was that about half the people didn't know they were talking to somebody else. Right.
Notice that the person standing in front of them had changed, that it was a completely different person.
Completely different person. And if you ask people, could you get away with this? They say, well, of course not. Of course you'd notice if you're talking to somebody different. And the reality is, no, you really don't. And the two of us weren't particularly similar looking. I was about 3 inches taller. My voice was about, he had a deep voice, talked with a slight Brooklyn accent. We had different clothes. None of that matters.
I promise my caller here in Urbana, I'll get to just a second. But it overall, what you see when you look at the things you look at in the book is that people are far too confident in their perception, in their ability to perceive accurately the environment. They're far too confident in their memories. They think their memories are rock solid, and they'll tell you they remember things that never happened. They are far too confident in their abilities in terms of sizing up the world and knowing what's going on. I mean, overall, we vastly overestimate our abilities in all these areas, which invites the question, well, why should that be? I mean, is there actually some sort of important function or reason for the fact that we really think that we're a lot sharper than we are?
Well, beyond just people tending to be overconfident in general, I think a lot of these sorts of mental illusions, these sorts of mistaken intuitions about how our mind works, follow really naturally from our daily experiences. Right? So we are aware of what we notice, and as a result of that, we are unaware of the things that we didn't notice. So we naturally assume that we're seeing everything that matters. Right? We, when we recall our memories of a personally important or nationally significant event, the memories seem really vivid and rich and detailed. So we assume that that vividness is the same as accuracy, even though it's not. So it's a natural set of assumptions to make that most of the time works quite well. Right? Most of the time, these limitations don't cause problems. Most of the time, there aren't people in gorilla suits walking through the scene unexpectedly. Most of the time, the person you're talking to doesn't change into a different person right in front of you. What we're doing in these sorts of studies is a lot like a visual illusion. We're breaking the system. We're doing something that doesn't typically happen in the world in order to see what sorts of default assumptions your mind is making. And it turns out that your mind tends to make the default assumption that it's seeing everything and remembering everything much more than it actually is.
Mm. Well, let's take some of the calls. We have several. We'll start here with Urbana, and this is someone on line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I think all of this is fascinating. I'm a yoga teacher, and we talk a lot about actually stopping the multitasking and trying to calm down, because so much of our world bombards us with so much information that it's actually somewhat destructive to our nervous systems. We get really overwhelmed. And I've been reading recently about people who are working with kids who have what often gets misdiagnosed is ADD or ADHD, but it's actually sensory perceptive disorders that literally their nervous systems have not learned how to appropriately discern what's important in a situation and what's not. So they just spend their whole lives overwhelmed. And so part of what these yoga teachers are doing is sort of working with the kids to try to help teach them to learn how to filter out of their environment what they need and don't need. And I think it's a sort of double-edged sword that you have. We need to be able to function in the world, and we want to be able to notice things and notice change. But at the same time, we have to be able to cut out stuff. And so I don't really have a question. I just wonder if you have a comment about, especially for kids who are, their nervous systems are very turned on, sort of what the implications of this is for that.
Sure. There are several interesting points you've made here. One is that what's the purpose of perception in the first place? And the purpose of perception in the first place is to extract the meaning of what's going on around us, to basically make sense of the world. And that's what we want to be able to take home. We can't store everything. We can't take in everything. We want to take in what matters. And people who have these sorts of sensory processing deficits are likely to be taking in things that don't really matter. They're more likely to be spotting the gorillas because they're not able to focus on the thing that they're supposed to be doing. And that's a real problem. This is something that does tend to improve with age, that we tend to be better able to extract what's meaningful quickly from a scene. It's hard to say what exactly you can do to train that. It's something that typically happens naturally. We start learning to extract what matters from a scene. I think it's really an interesting question whether there are techniques that could allow you to better focus and filter. And again, that's one of the take-home messages here, is that the nature of how our perceptual system works is it inherently is filtering. It's inherently blocking things out. And that's a good thing. You want to be able to block things out so that you can focus on what you care about and not get distracted by the stuff you don't. And to the extent that you have an inability to focus, it causes problems. So you wouldn't necessarily want to build a system, a cognitive system, that would always notice the gorilla, because that means it would always notice things that really had no bearing on what you were trying to do, and you could never get anything done.
Yeah. I think here we got an email from someone who makes the interesting point, said years ago he was watching a television show that showed how in the movies at the end of a reel there was a cue in the upper right corner of the film that was there to show the projectionist that it was time to change the reel. And he said that after that, every time he went to the movies, he always noticed that, but he said never before had he noticed it. And it seems, well, it's because you weren't looking for it.
Yeah, I didn't know about that. There are entire books and websites, hundreds, possibly thousands of them, devoted to film flubs and errors in movies. And most of these are written by people who spend all of their time, you know, using their DVD player or their TiVo and going back and forth and checking every single cut to see what's different. And it's a really hard thing to notice if you're not looking for it. In fact, film script supervisors, the people who are on set when making movies, I interviewed at least a couple of them for a book, the difference between them and you and me is that they know that they don't notice everything. They know they can't keep track of everything. They know they can't rely on their memory. And instead, they have to rely on every kind of cheat they can, taking notes, using pictures, using videos, and inspecting it to see what's different. If you're looking for it, you can find it. But most of the time, we're not going to be looking for those sorts of mistakes.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Have you tested people who are highly skilled meditators? And I'm curious if, you know, if you have, what differences you may have noticed, differences or similarities between people who, you know, don't have that kind of training and skill developed. And I don't mean somebody who's just been meditating for a little while, but people who, you know, can even consciously change their brainwave patterns, things like that. I mean, they're really skilled, and you've tested them.
I haven't personally, but I'm collaborating with a group in Italy that has been testing some monks, Buddhist monks, who are really experienced meditators. And the data are still kind of coming in, but the preliminary finding is that they aren't actually more likely to notice unexpected things. Even though they're meditating in a practice that's designed to let them take everything in, as long as they're trying to do the task that we give them to do, they stay very focused on it very effectively. So in some ways, it's hard to predict exactly what would happen there. Would meditation make you better able to focus and filter out distraction? Or would it make you more open to unexpected things, which would mean you're less focused? It's not clear that you can dramatically change the limits of attention, even through extensive meditation. It might change how you focus your attention, but it's not necessarily going to change the structural limits on what you can do and what you can't do. Yeah. But I think it's a really interesting question to look at.
We have also here an email from someone who asked this question. How does the concept of inattentional blindness apply to one's performance and success in games like bridge and chess? And is there any way to overcome those problems to train your mind to process all the relevant evidence before you decide on a bid or play or move?
It's a great question. I'm actually a chess player and an amateur bridge player. But I don't know that it's actually inattentional blindness so much that's the issue there. Right? It's the limits on memory. It's not so much that you fail to notice the card that you're holding or that there's a queen in the wrong position in the board. It's more whether you can remember what's happened before or think about what's going to happen next. And in some ways, it's not that easy to get past these limits on what we can do and what we can't do. There's no way to automatically notice everything or to automatically remember everything. That said, practice really helps. So you can acquire skill through practice, and you can improve your memory for the specific elements of the game through practice. So if you're playing bridge, you can practice studying the distributions, the possible distributions of cards, so that you don't have to spend time counting. If you're playing chess, you can study the openings and try and automate some of your thinking about them so you don't have to think about every single move. You kind of know what the best move is for some subset of the positions. So again, it's a lot like the case of driving, learning to drive, where you have to automate knowing how hard to press the accelerator. You can do the same thing for cognitive skills as well, so that they become more practiced and take less effort.
But it sounds like then, though, does that then end up sharpening those skills that apply to that task that probably doesn't make you any more likely to see the gorilla, though, if you put the person in that kind of situation?
That's exactly right. So practice makes you better at the thing you practice. It doesn't tend to transfer very broadly. So there's a big movement these days on things like brain training games and programs that are designed to kind of improve your brain, make you younger. And what most of the evidence suggests is that practicing those tasks makes you much better at those tasks. And that's a general principle of learning. The more you do something, the better you get at it. But the more you do crossword puzzles, that's not necessarily going to improve your ability to remember your friend's name when you meet them on the street. It's going to improve your ability to do crossword puzzles. And if you like doing crosswords or Sudoku, by all means do crosswords and Sudoku, but don't assume that that's necessarily going to keep your mind alert in the same ways as other sorts of things might.
Here's a caller in Terre Haute, Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is quite interesting, but your guest has made a couple of bloopers earlier, he said, when explaining the kid stepping out in front of the street. So I got a little chuckle out of that. But he's also, in my opinion, misusing the terms intuition and illusion for the simple what is a lack of perception. Thank you very much.
Well, there are a lot of different definitions of the word intuition, and the way we're using it here is thinking about intuition being something like a gut feeling, a kind of intuitive way of thinking that's different from kind of a deliberative, rational, analytical way of thinking. There's been a lot of discussion of the usefulness of gut instincts and making complex decisions going with your gut or going with your intuitive feeling. That's the sense of intuition we're using. I know there are other sorts of definitions of intuition that we're not referring to, more spiritual sorts of definition of intuition. That's not so much what we're after here. We're using the word illusion as an analogy to a visual illusion. So a visual illusion is a case where no matter what you know about it, you can't help but seeing it wrong, right? So when you look at a visual illusion, say that Escher staircase or some other sorts of visual illusions, you tend to see them even if you know what's going on in the scene. You know that there's something wrong there. You can't help but see it. It's an automatic aspect of our visual system. We're using illusions in the same sort of way to refer to our cognitive systems. So there are things that we can't help but assume about how our mind works, and we get it wrong. We don't see the way our mind works the way it actually does.
We are just about out of time. There's another question that here came in email that I think is really interesting. We don't quite have enough time to deal with it completely, but I want to ask it, and so you can talk about a minute. The person is wondering, you know, to what extent can you take the kinds of things that we're talking about here that have to do with people's perceptions and then apply that to how it is we understand and all, how people's fundamental convictions about politics, for example, develop?
I think that's a great idea. I don't know if we can predict political beliefs or political persuasions based on these sorts of phenomena. But what we can do is take a look at the assumptions people make. And people will tend to assume the worst of somebody if they're motivated to do that. So take the case a couple years ago from the Democratic primary when Hillary Clinton was remembering having been exiting a plane in Bosnia under sniper fire, right? And it never happened. There was actually a video of her having a nice greeting with a child on the tarmac. But that was her memory. It was really vivid. She was certain of it, and she didn't let it go for quite a while. Most people assumed, oh, she must be a bald-faced liar because of this, instead of assuming maybe it's just a memory distortion. Maybe it's just something that happens naturally to all of us. And in this case, she got caught out because there was video footage. All of us have memory distortion all the time. We just don't know it because we don't have archival records of what had happened.
Lots more interesting things in the book. I would suggest people take a look at it. If you'd like to read more on the subject, look for the book The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intuitions Deceive Us, published by Crown, the co-author, our guest, Daniel Simons. He's professor of psychology here at the University of Illinois. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives.
WILO programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
It's a minute and a half before 12 noon. Good morning. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. I'm Jay Pierce, sitting in for Celeste Quinn today. And coming up in this hour, we'll have our usual assortment of news and information. And also a conversation about Sprouts at the Market. It's an effort to give 3 to 8-year-old kids a head start in discovering fresh foods, organic foods, and good nutrition. That'll be coming up in this hour during the Afternoon Magazine. Right now, an update on markets. Hard red winter wheat for December in Kansas City at 762, up 11.5. The March contract, 774, up 11.5. And May, 771, up 10. December wheat in Chicago, 732.5, up 13.25. March at 760, up 11.25. May, 768, up 9.25. December corn, 512.75, up 16.75. March, 524.5, up 15.75. May, 523, make that 528.75, up 15.25. And July at 531, up 14. October crude oil, 73.57, down a dollar. Ethanol at 213.4, up 6.1. And the October RBOB gasoline contract at 191. And 31 hundredths, up 1 and 17 one hundredths. November soybeans, 1061 at a